Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's for Women. Discover female health insurance through It's for Women.
Hello, happy Easter. Sit back and have a listen to this, our weekend podcast. Follow us on Spotify for the weekly selection of our favourite chats from the last couple of days. On this episode, historian Jo Kerrigan. She was a hoot. She tells us all you need to know about fairy forts and the perils of disturbing them. Three priests on finding fame with chart success, keeping the faith and now hanging up their microphones after 50 years. And the great comedy genius Jerry Stembridge of Scrap Saturday gets stitched up as our visiting critic going to a sewing class. Have a listen and stay in touch. Oliver at RTE.ie. Happy Easter. The mystery and folklore of fairy forts are still very much alive all around the island. Roads curve around to avoid them. Farmers don't plough through them or over them or cut down the trees. Historian Jo Kerrigan joins us now live from our Cork studio to explain these ancient mounds, the ring forts or raths, lisses, cashels in some places, and why they hold such power over us. Good morning, Jo Kerrigan.
Good morning to you, Oliver. I'm sorry you've got so much rain. It's usually us.
It usually is. What part of the world do you live in now?
I live out on the road towards Killarney, on the Cork bounds, coming close to Killarney.
Oh, very nice. It must have been beautiful there this morning.
Oh, it is so beautiful down here. I don't know why you haven't all moved down here.
Because we'd ruin it for the rest of you. That's why.
That's true.
Come here. You came in from beautiful West Cork, but you have many doctorates and letters after your name. Tell us what you studied first of all.
I'm not sure I should really, because my first degree was my first master's was in Victorian melodrama.
Was it?
Okay. It was, because I loved the idea of villains and heroines and superheroes and everything coming happy in the end. I thought mislit and modern depressing theatre was rather a dreary thing, so I thought, let's go for melodrama. And I loved melodrama. Then later on, when I'd finished at Cork, I went over to England and did a doctorate in travelling theatres. We had travelling theatres in Ireland for much longer. They continued until the 60s here in Ireland, travelling theatre. So I did a PhD on the ones over there. And then much later on, after I'd finished working for The Guardian and working on getting Rutland back its freedom, I went to Oxford and did a master's in medieval history, which I loved.
And there is where you start
studying
the ring
forts. That's where I started.
Yeah.
I talked to them about going on to do another PhD there. And they said, shouldn't you be going back and discovering Ireland? Because there's so much left to do there. So I came home.
How long were you away in total?
About 25 years.
Oh,
I was in England, and you sort of get used to it, though they do tend to make fun of you if you're Irish rather a lot.
Do you get used to that?
No, you don't.
You don't.
You're talking about splitting the atom or about, you know, something really important, and they laugh at you saying, you're not Irish, are you? And and you thought, you could at least listen to my intelligence instead of going on my words.
Some of them are grand, of course, as well.
Some of them are grand. I had some lovely friends there. But it was right to come back to Ireland and start looking at our own history.
You do it, Edward. What did you do for The Guardian, incidentally?
Oh, I was working on advertising.
Were you?
And I was chasing around. They sent me on Education Guardian for the advertising, and I was able to go up to all these old universities around Scotland and places like St Andrews and it was wonderful, staying in haunted inns and exploring places and talking to lovely people. I was probably no good at advertising, but I did love the people I met.
You didn't lose the accent at all then? You still sound lovely in Irish to our ears.
Well, one can, when it is necessary, adopt the accent of those to whom one is speaking. It depends on where one is. I'm not sure I could ever get the Dublin accent, though. I don't think I'd ever get that one.
Oh,
Asher, I think you will.
You should have been in a travelling theatre yourself.
Wouldn't it be fun?
You could have done any of that. You seem to have lived several lives.
Yes, and this one's even more fun when you're going back into our own ancient time. You were talking about people getting a face peel or getting, you know, attention to their skin and watching, you know, do Facebook. And everyone's living in a virtual world now. And back in our time in Ireland, we lived with nature. We lived absolutely. You know, you're all shocked in Dublin at the moment because it's raining, because you never get rain. Dublin's always dry. We're so used to it, we don't even mention it.
Oh my God, and don't even mention Limerick. Sure, it's all the time. All the time coming down there.
It
feels like it's never going to be sunny again here at the moment. But come here, the fairy forts. And by the way, congratulations on the book, I should say, first of all. It is beautifully put together. There's lovely photographs as well by Richard Mills, who you know very well.
I should do.
He's your partner.
He's my husband.
He's your husband.
He's my husband.
And you were going out, was it? And then you disappeared into separate lives and then came back together. What's, there's a nice
story
there.
We were up at university together in Cork. And then we had a silly row one night. I think I wanted to go to a theatre and he wanted to go to the cinema. And we didn't see each other for a very long time again. I always meant to. And we didn't.
What was the gap?
30 years.
You had a row with the cinema and the theatre and didn't...
Well, it just we had other ways to go. It does happen in your life, you know. You have other ways to go in your life. And I was pursuing my studies. He was pursuing his rather brilliant career as a photographer. And we just went different ways. And I went over to continue my studies in England. And then I came back.
And?
And saw him again. And it was as if I'd never left.
Did you seek him out?
I did.
Yeah.
I popped in and said, by the way, remember me? And...
Where did you pop into?
Oh, the Examiner office in Cork, of course. Where else would
you go? That's where he was, taking photographs.
That's where he was, yep.
And you went in and said, remember me? And he said, I do.
We went and had a drink together and that was it.
And how long ago was that?
That was about 25 years now, 22, 23 years now almost.
We're supposed to be talking about ring forts, but my God, what a lovely, lovely romantic story that is.
Well, it worked out terribly well because we'd both got a lot of life out of the way and we both knew where we were going. And since then, the combination on our books, this is our seventh book, for heaven's sake.
Yeah.
We've worked on books together and we argue all the time. Richard wants a photograph taken this way and I want to talk about that one that expresses what I had in my writing. And we never stop arguing over them. It's lovely. And the books are just coming one after the other. It's great.
And the Irish Fairy Forts, Portals to the Past, did you fight making that one?
Yes, it was difficult because Richard would want to get the best angle on something.
Oh, yeah.
And I would want to say, but look, I need to express this. I want to express what's secret and what's underneath it. And he said, well, how do you suggest I express what's secret and underneath it?
How do I photograph the underneath? You can't, says you.
Yes.
So there are lovely photographs with drones and so on, I presume you used.
Yeah, we had to use drones. Yes. You have to be careful where you use drones. There are places you're not allowed to use them. I mean, you're not allowed to fly right over.
You have to be licensed
office,
and know
works,
what you're doing.
But with the others, it was a way to get things that people would never see because you don't always see the fairy fort until you're over it. They go, gosh, yes, it is one.
Yeah, they are. There are missing from, like, along the roads. You'll see them here and there, but you'd need to know where to look, wouldn't you?
You'd need to be standing on a high hill or using a drone and you suddenly realise that there are three or four or five in the valley below you. And that's where you start asking the question, hang on a minute, how come there are so many of them left? And that's the important thing.
That's the question.
Because, you know, in Ireland, you don't have to be told, Oliver, we're developing... Everywhere. We're digging up fields, we're building new houses, we're building factories. If there's demand on land everywhere. And the fairy forts are still there. Down near here, near Ringaskiddy, we've got a huge number of pharmaceutical and other industrial companies.
Yeah.
And yet in the middle, there's a tiny field with a ring fort in the middle of it, right in the middle of it. And no one dares touch it.
Brilliant. And there are tens of thousands of forts all around the country.
Yes, there are. They're everywhere. And they're much older than you think they are.
Really?
Now, the archaeologists talk about them and they say, well, some of them might have been inhabited 300 years ago, 400 years ago, but they're just ring forts. They're just earthen enclosures. Nothing else to see here. Move on. And I thought, that isn't the way you treat something as magical as a fairy fort. If you ever find something that's a fact, don't ever say, oh, it's just. It's never just. Pick it up, look underneath it, look around it, and then ask the sideways questions. Why is it still here? What was it really for? And why are people so afraid to touch them?
They're so embedded in the... By the way, are they in other countries as well?
You'll get a few in Scotland and a few in Wales, but mostly there they just call them forts, Roman forts, because they haven't really bothered.
Yeah.
Again, it's the archaeologists who just say, oh, there's nothing here. It's just an old shelter for cattle.
Why were they always circular? Why were they rings?
Ah, that's the Celtic thing, circular. Ah. We were always circular. It's how we represent everything.
Mm.
The squares and angles and hard corners come from a Roman time. They come from a later time in other countries. If you find a really old graveyard here, it'll be circular.
Really?
Yes.
It's an old Celtic pagan thing? Or
yes,
well,
it is. Everything was always circular. All our ring forts, all our little stones, Bruna Boyne and Newgrange, you know, all of the old ancient sites that we have around Ireland, they're all circular as well. It's the magic circle. It's like you get in Wicca or the other pagan Anyone who practices a pagan religion will know that you have the circle. You make the circle of power. You stand inside a circle to protect yourself, or you put a circle around something to keep it safe.
So going around in circles should be a good thing, actually.
It is a good thing. It is quite a good thing. It was later ideas coming from the Anglo-Saxons across the water, or from the Romans who influenced them, that things should be square and angular. No, they shouldn't. They should be circular.
The clue is in the name, place names all around Ireland, that there's going to be a fairy fort somewhere in the area, isn't there?
Yes, Rathniska or Rathmore or Lisnaski or Lisarda. You'll find them anywhere. Lisdoonvarna, which is two in one. It's got the Doon and it's got the Lis in it. You get them all over the country.
Lis and Doon. And do they, does the Lis and the Ra and Cashel, of course, do they kind of describe different types of ring forts?
Yeah, they do. The Doon and the Cashel are usually the very large ones, which were the kingly ones, where a local monarch, as we had many kings in Ireland then, we still do, I think, they would have had big stone forts. But they don't collect the stories the way the smaller ring forts, the little magical, hairy, fluffy thing you see in a field, all covered over with brambles and with fairy trees. That they're the ones that have the stories around them, the legends that make people afraid to damage them or touch them or do anything to move them. And the stories of what happens to anyone who dares to stupid enough to do it are frightening.
Can you give us an example?
Well, didn't you say Monaghan earlier on?
Oh, there was one in Monaghan. There was plenty of them in Monaghan, sure, there were little hills. And there is a famous story, isn't there? A famous case.
Yeah, there's one. What is it? Richard Lundy. He was a wealthy man living in Ardnagh. And he knocked down the fort. He was told not to. People told not to, but he did it. And while he was actually working at it, directing his workmen, his two horses that were pulling the gear for him dropped dead. And then his daughter lost her sight. She went blind.
Oh, my God.
And I think and all his stock died that year. All the animals he had on his farm died that year. And the story I got that from the school's collection, says shortly after, the name of Lundy was not in Ardnagh. The name of Lundy was gone forever. They disappeared. Oh, there's more in Monaghan. Crikey, there's a fort where if you pass it at night, there's a cat, a huge black cat comes out and attacks you. And it won't let you out of the area until you go away. And there's another place in Monaghan, it's just a place I'm mentioning because they've got them all over Ireland, where they used to pull out, the people lived in a house near to the fairy fort, and the fairies would come in at night and use their sewing machine.
Right, okay.
They'd pull out the old treadle sewing machine in the middle of the floor.
Destroy
and you'd hear that machine going. It's like that one in County Cork I knew. My father told me of some friends of his, the twins, the Conran twins. They had a poltergeist in their house because they were near a fairy fort, and he used to come out and turn the handle of the mangle. You won't know what a mangle is.
No, go on, tell us.
It's what you used before you had these modern washer dryers.
Squeezing out the clothes.
Yeah, you'd squeeze the clothes through it and you'd turn a handle and the sheets would be dry. Would you take a lot of the water out of the sheets? Well, they used to hear this at night, turning away in the kitchen, the mangle going crangle, grangle, crangle.
I can imagine that. They were fierce efficient, but no health and safety whatsoever.
No, you didn't have health and safety. This was back in Ireland when we're still like that, really, Oliver. We believe in nature. It's our instinct. When you get modern Johnny-come-lately religions like Christianity from Rome, they came in and they tried to change all of our old ways where we believed in nature gods and nature spirits. There was someone you went to when you wanted your crops to grow. Yeah. There was someone you went to when you were hoping that you would lots of children. There was someone you went to when you wanted to make sure that your neighbours were nice to you. And you went to different gods for different things. And that was an Irish nature-based religion. Mm.
They kind of replaced the saints, didn't they? They made the saints have specific superpowers for each
Bridget,
thing.
Yes. Yeah. Bridget, she was our goddess of crafts and of all this time of year, all the young lambs and the sheep, and she was careful of everyone. But the Christianity couldn't get rid of her.
Saint Anthony for finding things. They all have their individual powers. But come here, the folklore around it, is that commission in the 1930s that set up, that's important to collecting these stories,
that's
preserving them, passing them along.
Incredibly important. Yeah. I have to give credit to our very new Irish government at the time. It was after we'd become the Irish Free State and we realised how much we'd lost by having a completely different culture, the Anglo-Saxon one from England, taking us over. And if you remember, during all those centuries that they were taking us over, we were trying to keep our own culture, but Irish was outlawed and the old Irish legends and stories were outlawed.
We snuck them through hedges. And
we did.
We called them out to each other because we weren't
and we
staring
would
at
we whisper them to each other, and you'd get beaten in school if you were found even using them.
Really?
So all the old legends went away. And this, the government realised this in the 1930s, and they commissioned schools, every school in the country. The children were told, and they were young children, to go home, find their granny, their grandfather, or any old neighbours, the oldest people they knew, and ask them to tell them stories, legends, traditions, customs, way of working, way of farming, everything that they used to do. And they got the most wonderful collection. You can still look them up. They're online now, which is wonderful.
They're all digitised, which is a great thing.
But you can see the handwriting, this beautiful handwriting from a school, and the children saying, and my grandfather told me this, and he was shaking as he told me because he still believed it.
And many still do.
Everyone still does.
That's why so many of them are still protected.
Are still there.
Yeah, and protected really by folklore, isn't there? Because some of them get destroyed when the planning allows. That has happened.
And that goes into trouble when they do. There's a wonderful story down on the Killarney Road beyond me, excuse me, where they had to cut through the edge of a big fairy fort, a tri-valleys one. There's three walls and a very valuable one. But they had to. And the resident engineer in charge at Kerry County Council said, please don't do it. And they went back and they tried again. And they said, I can't, because the road has to be a certain width and the road has to be, and you can't go in there and we have to do it.
Yeah.
So he said, all right then, you're cutting a slice off the side of it. I want a wall made along, sheltering what's left, you know, bandaging it, if you like.
Yeah.
And on that wall, I want you to put in circles of stone to represent the three circles of that fairy fort.
Interesting.
And which was wonderful, because he wanted it left to show the fort that he was sorry and that, you know, we're doing what we can to recover. And, you know, even then, he couldn't get it done properly because the lad who drove the digger refused to do it. He flatly said, I am not going to damage that fairy fort.
We'd have to get people in to do that sort of, who mightn't know the stories.
Yeah, he said, well, I had to give him by leave and we get in a stranger to do it, and he did it all right for us. And it's worked out since, he said. I think the good people accepted it themselves. You'd never call them the fairies. You'd always say themselves, or the good people, or the other people, or the other crowd, I think somebody calls it.
The other crowd?
Yes, Eddie Lenehan, the folklorist, calls him the other crowd.
Yeah, he's the master of all of this.
He is.
Yourself and Richard, you had your own experience at a RAA?
We did. We went out to one in North Cork. And we went round it. We were careful enough not to go in. And we went round the edges and said, all right, we'll get a picture here, we'll get a picture there. And all Richard's camera batteries went dead. And we said, come on, Richard, you usually charge them. He said, I always charge them. They are never wrong.
And his spares.
Yeah, and his spares in the bag were completely dead. So we went back to the car thinking, what the heck is going on here? And the car wouldn't start. And now, look, he's used to driving. We tried everything. We tried this, we tried that, we tried the other. We went round to the back, went to the front. We undid things, we put it back. And it would not start. So we rang the AA and they said, well, it'll be at least 2 hours where you are. And while we were waiting, several farmers passed us in their tractors. And as they would do, they stopped to ask you, they do down there, can we help? Can we do anything to help? And when we told them what had happened, they all said the same thing. Well, what do you expect when you're annoying themselves?
Themselves.
And when the AA turned up, a really tough guy in the yard, he said exactly the same thing. Well, listen, if you're going to interfere with places like that, you must expect everything you get.
It'd put your heart in your mouth.
Tell
us about Amascán Mariacht.
The Amascán Mariacht. Oh, yes. That's where something comes over and you don't know where you are. I must admit that I used to think this was just an excuse for getting home late from the pub. Honestly, dear, I couldn't tell where I was and I got lost. And then I thought it might have been the pooka who comes on people at night and throws them up on his back and gallops over a hill with them and dumps them in a bog. But the Amascán Mariacht is genuine because I know a fellow who studies the Gaera, which is an flooded alluvial forest near us. And if you go in there, you forget what direction you're going in and you don't know where you are. And you can't find your way out. And I talked to a chap in a cafe one day and it terrified me. And him, we started talking about the Amascán Mariacht and he said he went down to a field. I remember he said it was down by the river and I hadn't ever ploughed it, but I thought, now a nice summer night, I'll go down and plough it.
Yeah.
And he went down, it was getting dark, and he went in and he started to plough and all of a sudden, thousands of birds, he didn't know if they were geese or swans, they just came in the sunset and crowded round him and flew all around the tractor until he couldn't move. And he was very scared and they were there till it got dark and then they flew away and he thought, right, I'll get on with it. And the tractor wouldn't start. And then he thought, right, He got out, managed to get the tractor to start and tried to get out of the field, and he couldn't find the way out. Now, he knew the field. He'd driven into it enough times. He knew perfectly well where the gate was. It wasn't there.
Mm.
And he went round and round and round, and he was getting a sweat on, he said. And then he heard midnight chiming from the clock.
Totally disoriented.
From the church. And they saw. Then he saw the gap, and he got out.
The mask on Mariacht.
What
do we believe is going on at these fairy forts? What it's an entry to the other world.
It's an entry to the other world, to themselves. It's their fort, because our tradition is that when the Celts came to Ireland, they drove the two of their Donnan, the fairy folk, underground.
Yes.
And that they stayed there. Some say they played a trick on them for doing it by they saying, look, we'll take Ireland half and you have half. And the two of the Donnan, who were believed in good things, said, yes, OK, we'll do that. But they tricked them. They said, you can have the half under the ground.
Mm-hmm. Because there are souterrains, aren't there, little tunnels?
There are. They were probably used at some time for storage or for escape if you wanted to hide from people.
Yeah, mostly storage. And they're really well built, aren't they? Flagstones.
They are. They're very strongly built. Most of them have been blocked up now, and you can understand why. You can't have kids going in and getting lost in
That's
them
right,
or,
fall, yeah.
or cattle falling into them or sheep and things. But there are souterrains underneath, and they believe that this takes you into the fairy world, the other world. And if you do go in there, you might not get back.
My gosh, there's a huge one. I don't know if you visited a big one overlooking Yall Bay, which is in a townland literally called Ra. We know it in East Cork, where the mammy's from. And it has a souterrain in it. We used to go into it as kids, but we warned to be careful, be Cúramach.
Oh, good. Yes, you were always warned to be careful. I know everywhere I go, I'll get people who's even people who say they don't believe in any of this rubbish and any of this nonsense. They say, but I do know one thing. I would never touch a fairy fort.
Wouldn't dare.
That would happen to you. And the stories of things being struck blind and people going lame and people, all their animals dying or their family going ill.
Archaeologically speaking, then, were they residences? Is this where people lived once upon a time and up to, what you said, 300 or 400 years ago, would people still have been in them?
People could have been in them 300 or 400 years ago.
Yeah. Cranogues, is that?
Cranogues are the little islands in the lakes. They were just practical shelters. You built a little island out in the lake out of logs and you stayed there and you could pull up the drawbridge if anyone nasty came by, as there usually was, because every county in Ireland was always fighting with every other county. Yeah. Aren't we still doing it?
We are, in our own way.
But the old, these enclosures were, first of all, there were shelters. You bring your cattle in there at night and you could build your little hut inside it.
That's what it is.
But they've been considered as fairy places far, far longer. One of our oldest documents, the Dinn Siancas, which is the lore of places. You remember when Christianity came to Ireland, they brought writing with them, writing down records. Before that, our ancient people, our druids, would only pass it down by word of mouth.
Yes.
Rather like spells. You don't pass something down by writing it down, because then anyone could share it. As you know, it's the ownership of stuff today with everything online. It's a difficult thing. Who owns something?
Yeah.
But in then, they always passed it down by word of mouth. And then when Christianity came, it had this common sense, along with trying to turn us into Christians, they had the common sense to say we should record these. And so they got all the druids and all the kings and all the knowledgeable bards and poets in and got them to tell them what they knew, and they wrote them down. So the actual stories of Dinn Siancas go back into the mists of time.
It's that
way
old.
Back BC, far, old, far
yeah.
back.
Way, way beyond.
And that is where they actually mentioned the fairy forts and the fairy mounds.
Is there a reason why the little fairy forts that we see around the place tend to have hawthorn trees? Nearly always the same type of trees, aren't they? Hawthorn,
oh, the hawthorn,
elderberry.
The Scioog, the fairy yeah. tree.
Yes,
it is the fairy tree, and it has its own legends attached to it. They live in it. They live in them as well. The good people might inhabit them, because you have smaller good people who will go and look after different things. They look after streams, they look after rivers, they look after the trees, and particularly the fairy tree, the Scioog, which is just coming up to May now. I hope you will tell everyone to go out and wash their face in the dew on May morning and go and gather branches of the May tree.
Wash your face in the dew? I never heard
yeah.
of that one. Really?
You're back. Did you not do it? Mentioned to it as
yet.
Well as
is
women,
there
you
time?
Know.
My God.
It keeps you beautiful. You go out at dawn and you wash your face in the dew, and then you bring in the May blossom, the hawthorn blossom, which will be out for May Day.
The May bush.
Yeah, and that's the only time of year you're allowed to cut it, because if it comes into your garden or into your field, you're not supposed to touch it.
Only a small bit of it now, yeah.
You can bring it in on May morning and put it over the door of your house and put it over the door of barns and sheds to protect everyone for the year against the evil eye.
Oh, God.
And if you're up on the Kerry border, you can go up to the Cahir and get water from the well there by the hawthorn tree, which is for your animals. Wow. And I still see people going up there, old farmers getting out with a lemonade bottle and filling it at the well and bringing it home for the cattle, or bringing their dog or cat up to the well to drink. It's lovely.
And the pattern days, that kept it going as well.
Yeah,
you have
it kept
the
it
red
going.
Trees.
People would come up there and would gather and they would dance and they would sing and they would drink. And of course, the Catholic Church tried to stop it, so they couldn't. You don't stop the Irish people having a good time.
Yeah.
So they put a
fairies never came for them. Isn't it funny?
How could they? They are our basic religion. We call them, they're our nature spirits. They're our ancient spirits of nature. And we are more naturally aligned to them than we are to, for heaven's sake, to social media and scientific knowledge. Scientific knowledge still can't do a buggering thing about the weather. The fact is, you've got the weather in Dublin today soaking you.
Or the sea.
Yeah, or the sea, the powers, the ancient powers are still there.
And you're a historian, we need to reaffirm again, and you're into all of this.
Oh, God, yes.
Yeah, you wouldn't doubt. I was worried for a minute there when you were talking about the fairies, your voice was starting to go, but you recovered now, so they must be happy with you, I'd say.
Well, they thought for a minute, when I had to have a drink of water, they thought that I was perhaps going too far and telling you too much.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
And I thought, oh dear, yeah, okay. I dedicated the new book to them, to the good people. I thought, saying, listen, lads, I'm sorry if we interrupted you and if we're revealing anything, but I haven't revealed too much.
No, you haven't. Well, the batteries died, so there wasn't much you could reveal. Same thing happened to Kevin, who's in touch here. Same experience for guests regarding batteries going dead. I'm a professional photographer, was taking pictures inside the Knockin Dolmen in County Waterford, had 3 spare batteries with them, all of them went dead 5 minutes, says Kevin.
Lovely.
But for the rest of us, we can indulge without upsetting themselves, because the new book is called Irish Fairy Forts, Portals to the Past by Joe Kerrigan and Richard Mills, that's himself, and the O'Brien Press have published them. Thanks a million, Joe Kerrigan.
It's a pleasure talking to you, Oliver.
Likewise. Enjoy the sun below. In 2008, 3 Irish parish priests hit the headlines when they signed a record deal worth £1.4 million sterling. Fathers Eugene and Martin O'Hagan, a pair of brothers from Derry, and their friend Father David DeLargy from Ballymena, released their debut album as The Priests. It was simply called, you remember that? There was a cross on the cover of the CD, and they travelled the world. They sold millions of records. They performed for 3 popes. They met Rihanna herself, recorded a music single for Christmas with Shane McGowan. And so I'm joined by the priests themselves, because what a story it is. All 3 of them are on the line. Good morning to you, Father Eugene, first of all.
Good morning. Good morning, Oliver.
Good morning. Father Martin is there as well.
Yes, that's me. Good morning, Oliver.
And Father David.
Good morning, Oliver.
Brilliant. Thank you all for joining us. Now, Father Eugene, we'll start with you. Tell us how 3 priests working in parishes, very busy parishes in the north, ended up getting this record deal.
Well, it's a surprising story. We were asked to do an audition. Sony were looking simply for one priest to act as a kind of a vocal bridge between tracks on a religious album that they were planning. When they heard the 3 of us singing together, heard our backstory, heard their 2 brothers who we've been singing for years, they came back and said, "Well, look, we're going to park that plan, and we'd like to make this musical album with yourselves if you're interested." Well, were we interested? It was, and that's basically how it happened. It was purely accidental. We weren't looking for it. Mm-hmm. They came and found us, and whoosh, it just went into another stratosphere.
It went global entirely. Father Eugene, you were all performing in music, weren't you? It was in your bones, in your soul.
It was in our bones and in our soul and our families. We were very fortunate, Martin, myself and David, to have been exposed to a musical family, and the nurturing and the encouragement that we received from them, and of course from our old school, beautiful, wonderful school with a musical, great musical tradition. So that set us up really for what happened in 2008.
And Father David, when you heard that Eugene and Martin were going to do this audition, how were you feeling about your chances?
First of all, I was glad that I was offered the opportunity to go and audition, but I didn't really fancy my chances, Oliver, to be honest, because, Eugene and Martin are such wonderful singers. I didn't really think that I was going to have much of a chance. But I thought, well, I'll throw my hat into the ring anyway, because you never know. And I'm very glad I did.
It really worked out. Sony, they weren't looking, as you say, for 3 priests. Somebody put it crudely, didn't they? They were looking for Pavarotti in a dog collar.
And yes.
they had a certain view of pop stars at the time, didn't you? And you didn't exactly fit that mould that they were looking for in 2008.
I think at that time they were looking for people who were young and good-looking and, you know, had a certain sex appeal, if I might put it that way. They certainly were not looking for three middle-aged priests. I don't think we kind of fit the... We ticked their boxes at that time. But clearly there was something there that they saw and were interested in and decided to go with it.
And a market for it as well.
Yes, absolutely. Obviously, you know, they were probably thinking of, you know, Catholic people across the world. But of course, the whole project appealed to so many more people beyond simply Catholic people. You know, it was really something that touched the hearts of people of kind of no faith and of other Christian churches.
Absolutely.
And so on. So it really was quite surprising, the reach that it had.
And Father David, you obviously weren't one of the two brothers. Did you all know each other, though?
Oh, yes, of course. Yeah. So Martin and I are classmates from school. Mm-hmm. We started school together in 1974. Eugene, same school, just a few years ahead of us. So we've been singing together really since the age of 11, since Martin and I were 11 years old. So we were kind of celebrating our 50th anniversary there towards the end of 2024.
Extraordinary. Because you've performed together in musical societies and whatnot.
We did, yes. Well, after leaving school, we came up to Queen's University in Belfast. We went to the same singing teacher. We were involved in choirs, you know, Queen's University choir, the university or the choir at the Irish College in Rome. We sang as a trio, you know, for various celebrations there, St. Patrick's Day, All the Saints of Ireland, those kind of big feast days. We would have done a sort of little trio act. We came back to Belfast, then we were involved in Castle Ward Opera, which is our local opera company at that time. And then we founded a choir together in 1995 called Cappella Ciciliana, which is still celebrating its 30th anniversary this year. Wow. So we sang with them from 95 up until 2008, and then we took a little break to kind of embrace the priests project.
When you did the audition and the Sony, obviously negotiations have to happen with the record company. How do those negotiations go? Martin, I suppose, if I send that question towards you.
Well, thank you. The negotiations went very, very well. We met in London after a bit of a whirlwind tour, getting all sorts of aspects in order, including the contract, of course. But in terms of the choosing of music, that was quite amicable. We sat down and came up with all those pieces that would be very popular. And I think there was a real sense of agreement in the room. And we decided to go for those pieces that people really loved and ourselves, like Panis Angelicus, Ave Maria, among others. So it was actually went very well. And they went with it. And the first album appeared, The Priests. But coming back to the contract, we on the morning of the contract, which sort of came out of the blue for us, we didn't expect to be signing the contract just so quickly in front of Westminster Cathedral. But we hadn't even informed the bishop yet at this stage. That was a very important issue to sort
out. That was a big one, yeah.
So Eugene was, as the venerable one of the group, he then headed over to the bishop and explained everything. So then he gave the green light. So thankfully.
Father
so
Eugene, was that a tense meeting?
No, actually, what happened was I'd actually told our press officer the night before, because I said, I think there may be some media interest in this. It just shows you maybe naive we were, unprepared. Mm-hmm. I think Sony and those who were around us kind of kept us, just said us enough information, but not too much in case we got frightened. No, afterwards I met the bishop. He came in and talked about some other completely other topic, and he says, "Well, now tell me about this recording deal that you've signed."
And he saw this on television, didn't he? He was watching this.
No, I don't think he was, actually. But he certainly heard about it very shortly afterwards from the press officer. But he said something very interesting to me. He said, "Look, now I know you've, because David and Martin have said we've been singing together in the diocese for years. So in one sense, it was an endorsement, shall we say, of the music we'd been making for a long, long time." And he said, "Look, you are talented. Music is a great gift. But remember also your gift of priesthood."
And that was it. And then he said, "Now you're the oldest. I'm putting you in charge of these boys. You watch them. Keep them on the straight and narrow. Don't let them veer off or jump out of the bowl they were baked in."
No throwing tellies out of hotel rooms. That was it.
No throwing tellies. Just be well behaved. And that was it. And he gave us his blessing and said, "Look," and he didn't know that, nor did we, that it was just going to be just as successful as it as became.
You were obviously very good at negotiating, Father David, because you got a unique clause that music executives certainly would not have been used to, because if someone has a career before they come to them, they tell them, forget it forever.
Yeah. Well, I think if they're signing up a new act, they'd like them to be available to travel the world to promote their albums and recordings and do concerts and so on. They basically want to take over your life. Of course, that wasn't going to be possible for us, given our commitments in our diocese and our parishes. So we needed to make it very clear to them from the get-go that we wouldn't be leaving our parishes. We would have a certain availability to them, but certainly not maybe to the extent that they might have wished. So they were happy enough to go along with that. They respected our commitments very much, and we were able to make it work in some fashion that was good for them and for us as well.
The first album, was that recorded in Rome?
There were parts of it that were recorded in Rome. Much of our vocals were recorded, believe it or not, much closer to home, in a wonderful recording studio up in Collibaki, believe it or not. And so we did a lot of our vocals there. The orchestra recorded elsewhere, but the choral backing, the choral parts that were sung by a Vatican choir, they recorded in St. Peter's Basilica, and we travelled over to record some parts of the album there with them. So it was a wonderful experience. They actually closed St. Peter's Basilica early to facilitate our recording, and there was just ourselves there. And so it was a magnificent experience.
That was an extraordinary honour to get, and that's to any of you, Eugene or Martin as well, because obviously, you had studied there, hadn't you, in the Vatican?
We had been there in the Irish College attending the Pontifical Gregorian University for our theological studies and other studies. So Eugene obviously had been there before us, and Martin and I went out in 1985. We were there till ordination in 89. So we our paths kind of overlapped there during that period, and we had chances to go to the Vatican on many, many occasions to sing for the papal liturgies, you know, at Christmas and Easter and at other times. So we were very privileged to have had that opportunity.
And we see in the documentary, obviously, the whirlwind really begins, doesn't it? The release of the album, it goes out into 42 countries on the one day. The success is just incredible. In fact, there's a Guinness World Record here.
It took us all very much by surprise, Oliver. And we were actually doing a TV programme in the UK one morning, and they surprised us by bringing out the Guinness Book of Records certificate and letting us know that we had achieved that. And it was for the fastest-selling classical debut act in the UK, a record which I believe still stands today. So, you know, you really have to kind of pinch yourself at times when you realise how the whole thing evolved and the success that it achieved. It was really marvellous.
Straight to number one, a million copies sold in just 5 weeks, and it goes up to 1.6 million. And these are physical sales, as they were in 2008, 2009. I mean, just extraordinary. Culture shock to you as well, because obviously suddenly you're on chat shows, you're meeting celebrities like Rihanna. That must be a great memory.
That was quite a bizarre moment. It was the Jonathan Ross show on TV, and Rihanna was one of the guests appearing that night. And and we met The Killers, and we met the actor Hugh Grant. We met different people, you know, at different times, and we met Take That. We met members of Boyzone. So they were kind of, it brought you into, a musical fraternity. We met some of our great classical heroes as well. Placido Domingo and Jose Carreras, and rubbing shoulders with people like that at the Royal Albert Hall. We had been nominated 3 times for Classical Album of the Year, and we got to walk the red carpet and do all that sort of exciting stuff.
Wow.
So it brought us into a completely different environment than the one that we had been inhabiting up until then. Very, very exciting days, I have to say.
It was you're obviously still doing your pastoral work, your parish work, funerals, baptisms, all of the usual. What did you make of stepping in from your normal world into this red carpet world of celebrity and entertainment?
Well, as I say, it was a whole new experience to us. It was the sort of thing that you saw in glossy magazines and in television and so on. And to find ourselves kind of propelled into that environment was very exciting. It was new. It was wonderful. But you had to kind of come back down to earth as well. That wasn't our lifestyle. And it wasn't ever going to be our lifestyle. It was, you were just kind of dipping into it momentarily, you know, a little experience, and then back to your parish, to the everyday work of a parish priest, you know, as you say, with the weddings and the baptisms, the funerals, the school visits, and, you know, the various liturgies and so on. So that kind of kept us very grounded. So you got these little, these highs, these great highs of the wonderful experiences, and then you were really back down. So that kept us level-headed, I think.
And you had to keep working, as you say. People obviously were wondering what priests were doing at a big record contract worth so much. But at the start, you announced very early on what was happening with the money. Is that right, Father Martin?
Yes, I think it was our intention always to endeavour to set up a trust. So we set up the priest's charitable trust, and so we did our utmost. It's a drop in the ocean, but nevertheless, we hoped that it would make some difference. So we did indeed try to help a number of different organisations, and still try to do that. So we helped with Sight Savers, for instance, and we also contributed to the setting up of a school called Hidden Treasure in Uganda. We've been working with a Presbyterian doctor who was doing a lot of work out there, and so we helped to support that. I'm very, very glad to do so. We also worked with an organisation in Thailand as well to help children who were on the streets, to bring them in and to give them support as well, and to help them to face the future with a little bit of hope. So there was a number of issues that we tried our best to help with, and musical aspects as well, to encourage young singers as well and other musicians to develop, and
the Ulster Orchestra and so on. Yeah,
the Ulster Orchestra, yes, and other organisations. But as I say, you know, these were done very, very quietly, and hope that many people will benefit in the future, sowing the seeds really in a sense, Oliver, for the future. So it's been a great honour and privilege for us to do so, and thank God we've had the ability to do it.
I hope you were able to pay yourself something as well. I mean, it's extremely hard work recording and performing all around the world and promoting what you're doing.
Yes, I mean, yes, in terms of you've got to keep the show on the road, I suppose, and that was part of the reality of this whole music world and industry that we were faced with for the very first time. You know, so in a sense, yes, it has been very positive, it's been very worthwhile. If we have something, it's a small amount that would maybe help us towards our expenses and to keep everything going. But otherwise, we endeavoured to bring the music as far as we could and as long as we could, and to have achieved 17 years when quite a lot of other boy bands had maybe slipped away and disappeared. There we were, singing middle-aged boy band. But anyhow, the music has been absolutely superb, and it's been a wonderful gift. Thankful to God and to all those who have supported us from day one. It's
showbiz absolutely suits you. It really suits you. Get the dig in there. That's perfect. Father Eugene, of all the mad showbiz things that went on, what an extraordinary thing to record a Christmas song with Shane McGowan.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there was a bit of a jaw drop thinking that, you know, we come from different musical traditions, shall we say, different genres, and we might be in a slower lane maybe than Shane in terms of music. But look, it was a pot shot. We approached him, and well, we weren't sure whether he would be interested. But you know, he was. I think his family and his mother kind of liked the sound that the priests made, and so he was up for making the track Little Drummer Boy, because it was a track that he loved himself.
Yeah.
And he provided the descant pieces in it and the pum-pum-pum element, and he did it extremely well. And we had a wonderful meeting with him in Dublin in the recording studio when I was a wee bit late, I have to say. Shane's not, I think, wasn't known for sharp timekeeping. No. But we waited and we said we wanted to meet the man. We wanted to work with him and you together rather than him record his bits and we record ours separately. Yeah. So we had a lovely couple of hours with him then in the recording studio and just chatting in the green room, you know, just about life in general. Mm-hmm. And I know people think that Shane wasn't, he wasn't too religious, but when we had a conversation with him, there was a spirituality in Shane that maybe was hidden and that came out in his poetry, came out in his lyrics, etc. And we just had that privileged little moment with him. So that's one of the highlights.
That was lovely. And he had a Catholic mass funeral in the end.
Yeah, so absolutely. He did,
This is a question for any one of you, I suppose. Do you think the music and what you did it bring people to the church at all? How did the two worlds collide?
Let me have a wee stab at that. In a gentle way. We weren't out to proselytise or to convert, through the music. But it has undoubtedly touched the heart and the souls of many people who already kind of knew the music and appreciated its depth. Then there were others who were maybe on the periphery of things, maybe not Christian in a sense. They were just searching for God, searching for the other in life, and they found a way in through hearing the music, and then becoming more interested, and then I think some people were in touch with us personally and others have told us their own stories that it kind of sparked something for them. And they went on a search and they found what they were looking for. And we helped, I think, to do that. And it was a great privilege to be able to do it. I don't think we realised we had that outreach, but it's hugely affirming and that we hear people's stories that the music has helped them. And that's one of the things we wanted to do when we were singing together.
Father David, obviously you got the blessing of the bishop to go ahead, but when the fame came and the success, was the hierarchy in the church generally happy? Because you're mixing with all these music industry types, you're appearing on chat shows and so on. Was there any blowback at all?
There wasn't any blowback at all. I imagine it was something that would have been discussed among the bishops and, the papal nuncio and cardinals and people like that. But there were people who knew us very well. Our bishops would have known us very well. Cardinal Brady had been, head of the Irish College in Rome. He would have known us very well. So I imagine that they probably spoke positively for us, I think they probably thought these guys are not going to, rock the boat too much. Let's just watch and see how it goes. And I think the fact that we had been asked or we had been able to record in the Vatican, we had been invited actually by the Vatican to come over and perform at an event taking place there for seminarians and novices and young people who are on a vocational path. We did that concert for them in Rome. So I imagine among themselves they had discussed it and decided that it was just worth watching and see how it evolves. But we felt that we had the support and the goodwill,
Very good. Well, the debut album was released. Obviously, you're all doing publicity around that. 2008, 2009 is a very challenging time for the brand of the Catholic Church in the world. Obviously, I think it's around the same time as the Ryan Report. That's 2009, which detailed the extent of clerical abuse and cover up. The historical scandals were swirling. You're out on a publicity tour for an album. You got asked quite a lot about this subject, didn't you? How did you deal with it?
We were nervous, I think, going into many of our interviews because we thought that this was an issue that would certainly come up. Mm-hmm. We hoped that we would be able to make a reasonable and considered response to it. And while we weren't sent out as spokespersons for the church, we obviously, as three priests, we had to. Be the face of the church, if you like, the official hierarchical church in that moment.
Yeah.
And we certainly didn't want to speak defensively about things. We had to acknowledge the harm and the hurt that had been done, the mistakes that had been made, and kind of reflect that sense of shock that many of us experienced ourselves. We were going through all the kind of emotions of disappointment and shock and anger, I think, as well, that was kind of about at that time. We were trying to come to terms, if you like, with our own, you know, emotional response to these things. Nice. And I think we did our best to reflect that in an honest way. Mm-hmm. But I think at all times, having a consciousness of the hurt and the harm that had been caused, and hopefully not sort of adding to that in any way, but maybe give an insight into how we ourselves maybe were feeling and responding at that time.
Which you indeed had to do back in your parish. Your fans are in touch with us on the text. Marie in West Cork says, can you ask the priest if it gave them the realisation that fame and money doesn't make you happy? Eugene, you're the boss.
No, fame and money doesn't make you happy. That is very, very true. I mean, we see that all the time in our social media and in our newspapers, etc. Yeah, I mean, in a sense, you know, fame is a bit of a drug, and then you get a high, and then you have to, in a sense, you have to feed it. And I think what happens is, you know, for maybe a singer, a musician, an artist, a celebrity, when you're not feeding that fame, you have to turn somewhere else, and that's the danger. Where do you go? What do you turn? Where do you go? And it's about maybe sometimes unfortunate and mistaken choices, rather than, you know, badness on the part of anybody. It's just bad choices at a time, and it has a pivotal effect on people's lives. And, you know, you hear all kinds of stories from our agent and manager, who tells us, you know, about kind of the rock and roll world of celebritydom and fame. People get all kinds of ideas about themselves, which are completely unrealistic, and that's going too far. So we were fortunate; we had good people around us. We were a bit older when we became famous, shall we say. We had a life experience to form us, and that kept us right.
Able to handle it all. Well, congratulations on the incredible story, and people can enjoy and they can watch. The priests don't give up the day job. Is that the name? Has it a different name on BBC as compared to RT?
Yeah, it's called Faith and Fame on the BBC, but I think
Faith and Fame
give up the day job is just as good.
Okay. That's on RT1 television at 6:30 on Easter Sunday, this coming Easter Sunday, and it tells your story. But for the moment, thank you so much for talking to us, Father Martin, Father Eugene, and Father David. Enjoy and good luck with Holy Week, because I know you're busy.
Busy.
Thank you.
Yeah. Happy Easter.
Same to you. Same to you all.
Thanks, Oliver. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Writer and director Jerry Springbridge is this week's visiting critic, as he makes himself comfortable here. You'll know he began his writing career across the corridor here, wasn't it, Jerry? Ortiz Studio 8, the hallowed room that it is.
Oh, you're talking about the first season of
Scrap Saturday. What year was that?
Yeah. What?
What year was it?
1990.
1990. Were there two, three seasons of it?
There were three seasons, but only across 2 years, I think.
Yeah.
Well, no, three. 90, 91, 92. Yeah,
it's hard to find out how many episodes there were per season.
I remember what I was paid.
You don't know.
I remember what I was paid, but I can't remember. I can't remember how many. But there were very few.
Well, you can tell us that
if
you want.
We operated the Basil Fawlty or the Fawlty Towers thing.
Only 12 episodes.
If you make few, they won't catch you out, and then you'll be
and they'll talk about it forever.
Be famous forever. Yeah. And here we are already.
Here we are.
Already, even though we have far more important things to talk about.
Oh, absolutely, because
I've brought my work with me.
As people will know, the visiting critic has to review something that you'd never think of doing yourself. Is that right? Are you not good at craft activities in general?
No. No, and anything to do with clothes is also something.
Oh, really?
I know nothing.
I always
about
thought you were dashing.
Anybody who might be listening now who would know me saying it. Did you tell them what? Have you already said what it is?
No, I haven't actually. Yes,
all right,
it's
okay,
sewing. You went to a sewing class.
I went to a sewing class. Yeah,
he's producing already. You know.
Well, actually, there's the very point. Yes, you're dead. You see, there is the very point. Is that when I was talking to your researcher Susan
wonderful team
about
yes.
what what we might do about, you know, because I have to say, I do enjoy the item. I think it's a very clever item and I think it's very good.
Oh,
and very often people are on it because they're people who don't normally review things or don't normally offer their opinions about things. This would not be true of myself. Offering opinions has been my lifeline for many a long year. However, so what I did say, just as a by the way, as a thing, is that I should do something that I know nothing about, and that is what would make me most uncomfortable, to be in a situation where I actually really don't know what the hell this is about at all. And when they came back to me with sewing class, I said, yeah, let's do that. Let's do a sewing class. Why not?
And you have some stitching with you. The sewing class was in Mary Street in Dublin, in the famous Pennies.
In Pennies.
The original Pennies.
In Pennies. That may sound, there may be a certain irony there of going to Pennies to do a sewing class instead of grabbing some bit of fast fashion and for $2.99 and racing out.
That's right.
However, can I, and can I also describe it? The other only mild shock to me was that when I arrived in to meet the people who were doing it, I discovered that it was actually happening in public view.
Oh, is it? Yeah. In the shop? Is it really?
Yeah, it's you. Anyone?
So
going,
shoppers are going by.
The shoppers are going by. There's a very nicely laid out kind of square of tables.
Yeah.
And the, I will say, fantastic Michelle stands in the middle of us all and chats to us and explains the stitches and tell us what to do. So I sat down there in, you know, with all of this going on all around me.
I believe it's a free class.
It's absolutely free. Yes, can I say top line? I absolutely recommend it to people. In fact, I urge them to go along. And male and female, I was sadly, and perhaps stereotypically, the only man.
The only fella there.
And to be fair to the other eight or so women who were there, not one of them at any point looked at me as though, because they didn't know I was there, you know, in this kind of
reviewing,
function.
Yeah.
They just assumed I was a man in his 60s coming to do some sewing.
Yeah.
There
was no judgment.
Sewing, and treated me accordingly.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah, it was absolutely lovely. And Michelle is fantastic. Michelle is one of these women who I would say, I don't know what you would have to do to get her to criticise you in any way. Yeah. I don't know whether, you know, you would have to perform a violent act or what.
Very encouraging, Moonjaw.
Just so completely encouraging and so very, and you know, when I did do something disastrous, she said, oh, that's very interesting. Oh, that's very interesting.
A mistake.
Oh, that's, that. Oh, look at the effect you've had there. Now, okay, but what if you tried it that way? And I instantly
is this hand sewing, by the way, or are you using machine?
Oh, no, hand sewing.
It hand is sewing,
yeah, because machines are probably that's probably the next level.
It'd be intermediate, maybe, is it?
You're moving on there. Yeah, moving on. Yeah,
foundation sewing.
Because you'd have to learn, you know what I mean? And I'm sure I'd have, you know, cut fingers and things like that.
Give you machine.
Michelle was fantastic. And so there was that. It was like you were brought back in beautifully into kind of early primary school.
Oh, lovely.
And some lovely teacher was making you feel like you had talent at something, which is very good. It's also a very particular form of sewing that she was, that this is all about. And this, I hope, it should encourage those Gen Zers and things like that. Or, you know, what do I know? What do I know anymore? But it's what do they call it? Anyway, it's stitching you can see. It's not invisible. That's what it's
is it?
It's not invisible mending. It's stitching you can see. So it's all about
very
putting
good
things on your clothes.
It would be like trim. You could have nice red trim on a
all of that
fetching jacket.
Exactly. Or, you know,
very straight lines. I'm looking at your
floral design. I will hand that over. Oh, can I just say before I do, though, get a load of that.
You have a beautiful sewing kit. That is.
If for no other reason, people should flock to this because they get a free sewing kit.
You get that.
Describe it. You're on radio. Describe
that's
it.
That's beautiful. Well, it is like school pencil case, isn't it? Double sided. You've got all your nice coloured threads on one side. And
loads
you've
of
got
threads.
Things I don't know the names of on the other side, but the thing that pulls.
Now, here's the test for you.
Through.
I want to see if you know as little as I do.
I don't know. I know that thing.
I'm now handing Oliver something.
It's like a plastic thing with a little diamond-shaped wire. I don't know what the name of that. I don't know what it's called. I hope you do.
But do you know what it does?
Does it pull the thread through?
You see, you're ahead of me already.
A complete idiot.
You're well done.
I thought you were going to give a beautiful word.
It is for threading the needle.
Oh, right.
And this was like, this will show you how little I knew and how excited I am about you having sent me to this. My life is transformed by this tiny, as you say, a red plastic handle with a, how did you describe it, a diamond
shape? It's a diamond shape. A diamond shaped wire.
What
that will literally go through
wire,
the head of a needle.
If I can just, I mean, this is a very.
Jerry's temperature.
Oh, no, I can't do that one.
The
I can't
needle,
do that one.
No,
this is great radio, isn't it? This is fantastic radio. You'll love it. But anyway, the needle. So what you do is, there's people all over the country laughing now, as they're thinking, he never heard of a needle threader.
Two twits in the studio have no clue.
But it is, because it is quite a large thing.
He's doing it now.
You can push it through
the eye of the needle.
The eye of the needle. It squashes down and pops back up again when it comes on the other side. Is this working for radio? Anyway.
What's the camel through the eye of the needle biblical reference?
Exactly. So what you have then is a very large piece, and then you can pop the thread into that and yank it back.
You're really happy after this class.
Well, I can tell you, over the years, my only sad links with sewing has been, you know, to attempt to put a button back on that is...
Yes, this is a life talent I wish I had.
Yeah.
My mother taught me for a while, a couple of years ago, and I've since forgotten. Do you now know how to attach a button back onto a shirt or a jacket?
Yes, in fact...
You do?
This will show you Michelle's work, which I was encouraged to be imaginative in my choice of threads.
So very, very good. You've even given a nice orange button, some purple thread. That looks very neatly done.
What?
It's very nicely done.
The secret is apparently that you go diagonally across. You don't go side by side, if you know what I mean. Anyway, that's a... the point being that the business of putting on a button was so terrible to me was because I would spend so much time trying to thread the damn needle in the first place. You see, it's like anything in the arts. Once you have the open sesame thing, then it all opens up before you. You can do
the opening line and then the page.
You can do everything. So I now have this little, of all the goodies that are in this free bag, which you get if you go and do the, am I doing an ad for pennies?
It's for sewing.
But you get this kit, this fantastic kit,
Is there a symbol? Do they have symbols anymore? No.
Yes. There's
a thimble and everything.
There is a thimble.
He's very excited about this.
Jerry,
your mother was a seamstress.
My mother was a seamstress. And that probably makes me more guilt. That's an unusual form of Irish guilt, maybe, is the idea that she did
everything at home. I
grew up. Well, actually, she made things more than but definitely mended. And the sewing machine was just like, you know, when you're a kid and there's things in the house and you think... Because you're a kid, they're in every house. That's what's in every house. You know what I mean? It's a kind of a peculiar item is part of that family history. And so a sewing machine, I assumed that was something everybody had. But being a boy and being, you know, interested in other matters, I just, you know, I barely watched
it's
her
not
doing...
for me.
What?
That wasn't for you.
Well, I don't think it even arose for me. Do you know what I mean?
Growing up in Limerick City.
That gets in Limerick City.
Proud Limerick man.
Can I just, you're going to have to talk through this because I'm now about to leave the microphone to demonstrate.
Have you got more sewing to demonstrate?
This is sort of, it didn't happen in the class, but it was an idea I had so excited was I by that.
Would you like a piece of Velcro? What is
that? How frayed.
A frayed piece of black Velcro.
It's not Velcro.
It's kind of a velvety, it's the seam of something.
It's the bottom of the leg of a pair of corduroy trousers.
Oh, right. Oh, yes. Okay. I can see the end.
These trousers are pre-COVID. And had been tossed aside as of no further use because the legs
had
and
they were too long and they were dragged under the heel.
That's exactly right. And
up and down the Clontarf seafront.
What I did, you have to know.
Oh my God!
I'm wearing them.
I thought it was a Padre Pio relic or something. It was handed to me. He's wearing the pads. This is extraordinary. Okay, now lift up your foot there to have a look at it. And he has repaired the seam of his black corduroy pants. It's a very neat job, both sides. I think this is the most successful visiting critic we've ever had. I'm blown away by that. In fact, I should be clapping and cheering for that.
Can I say the
clapping pennies? And cheering.
All right, sure. The pennies crowd. call it the whole school class thing so people can look it up online. Woo! Love it for longer.
Love it for longer, yes. It's all about sustainability and repairing. So those pants that would have ended up in the bin are now on you.
Yeah.
Your mother would be very proud.
Well on me is another thing.
They do. Yeah, you look like a proper writer.
Now, here's the thing. My mother, just to link that back, my mother would, of course, have repaired that in a matter of 10 minutes on the machine.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
And would have done but you did this by hand.
I did it by hand.
How long did it take you?
About 2 hours' work.
It was 2 hours enjoyable work.
Well, I was in the garden in the sunshine last week. Remember the sunshine?
Remember that? Yeah. That's never going to happen again.
Well, no, because you live in here, don't you? You don't.
Yeah, up I live there, in a windowless room.
Up there, the sun comes and goes.
What did your dad do?
What
did your father do?
My father was a coal man.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
So two very hardworking people.
Oh, very. Yeah. I mean, it was like, you know, the early 60s, right through the 60s. But, you know, as I was a child, you didn't know the economic circumstances. Everybody in the housing estate, which was a corporation housing estate.
So it's a little out of the city.
The state used to build houses. Remember
that? Also remember
that. And
let
people have them.
Also never going to happen again.
People have them for a small rent. And as long as they went out and worked reasonably hard, they could. Do you remember those days? Ha, ha, ha.
Anyway, the Irish dream. I love the cynicism is still in there, man.
Oh, is it? All right. And yet I can be
sewing can take you away to America.
And I would just like to point out written here. There's names on the stitches.
He's back to the sewing.
And one is mysterious because it's Michelle had names for all these stitches.
Very good.
And do you see what one is called?
No, hang on till I look here. It says back stem. A stem stitch.
Now, I foolish because...
In your honour.
Well, I foolishly thought that. It turns out no. The reference is to the fact that it's the kind of thing you can make the stem of a flower with or something like that.
Because it's a big bulky one.
See it there? Yeah. See the long...
Is that the way it's supposed to... It's the dotted one? It's supposed to be
what?
Nice?
That'd no, that's nice. The back of it, for God's nice sake. It's the front of it.
So, come here. You were one of... Were there 5 years or
he's
six
desperately trying to get me back here. He's desperately trying to get me off.
Don't do interviews, you see.
The point about the... I thought the whole point of this programme... Of this item was for
it's,
me
it's
to.
A trick. It's a trick to get you to talk about other things. I know. There, I've said
but,
it.
But come here to me. Are you going to tell people how to get to do the. And I
we are, of course. Yeah, no, don't worry. We circle back to it. You know, a circle kicker in writing?
Oh, very good. The American's okay. got. That's beautiful. Okay, phew. Let's do that. So my dad was my dad was a coal man.
Sewing days.
My dad was a coal man, and I mean, even for the youngsters, I knew this was a very tough job. And there's the other memory of a thing in the house that you assume is in every house, but it doesn't exist. And again, a bit like the a bit like the needle threader that you knew so much about.
He's now doing sound
radio. Do you remember Swarfiga?
Swarfiga? No, I don't. I don't remember this.
Do you know anything about Swarfiga?
No, I don't.
Swarfiga came in a tin. I wonder, does it still actually exist? And was an incredibly unctuous jelly-like green jelly. I loved it as a child. It smelt of petrol.
Oh, yeah.
And
it had petrol in it.
This is what... Oh, yeah. No, for sure. Because this is what my dad had to use... To wash himself.
To get the coal dust off.
To get the coal dust off at the end.
No, the nail brush.
Not on your face. Not on the face. Not on the face.
If you'd oily hands, I know the trick of fairy liquid and a spoon of sugar. And you get the oil off your hands.
No, obviously up in the border counties, they had a whole other thing that they did. Whereas down in Limerick, it was
the rationing still going over, throwing sugar into our hands.
And, so there was Swarfiga in the bathroom and my father, particularly when you think of winter time, you know, he wouldn't be home until, you know, 9 o'clock at night and just black because back then coal came in sacks and the sacks if it was
Hessian
raining
sacks.
And as you know it always rains in Limerick this we know
was that true yeah
no but anyway, so but you know what I mean it would seep through the sacks and it was just
he was covered in cold did he have a donkey jacket like Cillian Murphy in the film?
No, I don't remember my father being a donkey jacket man. And I did wonder about Cillian had he got I mean my father would certainly not have carried coal in the manner that Cillian carried it.
Yeah.
But that's probably a new thing. I would guess
it's set in the 80s.
I would guess Cillian, you know, sat with Coleman and,
oh,
and
I'd imagine.
His research.
Yeah. It was 6 months of it.
So I'm sure he was exactly accurate in the way it was like cradled or something.
Right down to the fold of the
It was over one shoulder. My father was always on the back, hanging on to the two bits of the sack and carrying them in. I would frequently go with him in the van, particularly on days my mother wanted me out of the house for as long as possible.
There was only one girl in your family among the siblings.
How do you know that?
We just know these things.
Yes.
Fantastic.
Just the one.
And four or five boys you were with?
Five.
Now, she is a literary figure now, isn't she, this woman? Sister of yours.
My sister is a major literary figure.
Now, she's a big reader.
She's a muse.
But her son... Yes. Is a Booker Prize winning author, Paul Lynch.
Paul Lynch. I am, in that context, by the way, I'm forever grateful that it was my sister's child and not only my brother's child, in which case he might have been called Stembridge, and we wouldn't want that.
You get to pop the secret out every now and again.
Not that, but it means that people don't instantly know that there is actually a more superior literary figure in the family. But my
proud uncle.
Yeah, no, my sister and my sister was actually something of an inspiration to me when I was growing up as an older sister, because she loved reading and had lots of books, mm-hmm. and I used to sneak into her room occasionally and have a read off the books that I wasn't yet ready to read, if you know what I mean.
Do you remember which ones?
There'd be a lot of the classics, do you know what I mean? Like your Wuthering Heights and your Jane Austens. I love that phrase, your Jane Austens. Jane Austen is what I mean. I mean Jane Austen. I don't mean your Jane Austens. Do you notice GAA people do that all the time? You know, they do, you're this player or you're that player. You mean that player is what you mean. You know, the likes of Oliver Callan.
You would know you're a teacher, given that.
It's a bit of that.
There is the tiniest
sliver of pedantry.
How long did you actually teach for?
Only 4 years.
4 years?
If it can be called
in
teaching. In Dublin, in Mount Temple, another famous. I'm surrounded. I always seem to find myself linked to fame in many ways.
Yes, an email in from David. Can you please say hello to my former history teacher, Mr. Stembridge? And Jerry was the only teacher in Mount Temple who had two briefcases, Marks and Spencer carrier bags, carried on each of his Honda 50 motorbike to help him balance. David is actually on the line. David?
Oh, God, who is it? David, who? Should I put on headphones?
Yes, you need to put on headphones. Good man, Jerry. David, who? He's wondering, David.
Good morning, Oliver, and good morning, Mr. Stembridge, a.k.a. Jerry. Jerry, David, my name's David McIntyre Barn. You might have remembered me as David Barn. My brother Ken was also a pupil at Mount Temple.
Oh, the name rings a vague bell. Go on. I assume you're only on the line because you have some embarrassing story to tell. Is that right?
To be fair, I got a great smile when I heard that Jerry was going to be on your programme this morning, as any time he has before, because he was a total inspiration as a teacher. His teaching style was absolutely fantastic. One of the things that I will share with you, Jerry, which might give you a chuckle, is when it came to class quizzes. And obviously Jerry had a contact in Cadbury's, because he used to make his way into Cadbury's staff shop. And you know the little bags, he used to get maybe four or five chocolates when they made them with decent fillings years ago. Anyway, Jerry would throw a question out to the class, like, when did the Vikings come to Ireland? If you got it right, he would then fire a chocolate down the classroom at you. Mrs. Prandy's class is actually the one that I just absolutely loved it. I would say the trousers, Jerry, that you referred to, that you're referring to, probably a good chance you might have had them.
I think that's the most accurate thing you've said so far. Absolutely. That's right. Do you remember them? Black corduroy? They were quite fitting. This is lovely. Lovely to hear my memory. My memory of it is slightly different, actually, is that when I asked a question and got the right answer, I then ate the chocolate. Would that not be...
Well, do you know what? As I say, it was a few years ago, as you know yourself. You know, as a class of 84, I think I came out on. So, that is actually... You probably teased us by eating them. Jerry, thank you.
The class of 84.
And can I also say, David, I'm glad that your education has meant that you can now lounge at home listening to the radio. whatever we did for you, it has allowed that to happen. And congratulations.
Well, thank you. What I would say is, Jerry, thankfully it is. I'm one of the folks who are lucky to get the old Good Friday off, so I will not complain. Yes,
and are you still on the north side?
Oh yeah, I am indeed. So as I say, still around. I work on the south side, but they let me back at night time.
I understand.
You're not a teacher, are you?
No, I'm not. I actually work. I'm a consular and passport officer with the Australian Embassy on Stephen's Green.
Fantastic.
So
he did very well.
Hello to my colleagues there. If anyone's listening there this morning, and. Just like to say, if I could, Jerry, you weren't the only star who came out of Mount Temple.
Oh, far from it.
There were many. In fact, David, a happy Easter to you. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Lovely to hear.
We're going to take a quick break and we'll be back with Scrap Saturday chats after this. You know, we have to
talk. And I'm saying no more about that.
Yeah, you had a big long chat during the break there. None of it broadcastable.
None of it.
Scrap Saturday, as you said at the start, 1993 short seasons. Charlie High is the most memorable thing, isn't it, about it? Because you can listen in, you almost don't need context. I loved when you used to bring Charlie with his imagined relatives from all around Asia.
Everybody loved that. That was a particular talent of Dermot's, actually. Dermot wrote all of those.
He had the flow.
I can claim no part in them other than enjoying them. And it came from a very simple, you know this from your work, a very simple thing arises, something that a politician says not realising the consequences, or maybe enjoying the consequences. but Charlie made a couple of different speeches, or more than a couple, in different places, in which he alluded to, as politicians did then, his links to wherever it might be, Derry, Mayo.
This is PJ and CJ on his European, of course, background.
Okay, no, I'm only saying you'll always have the knockers and the big grudges, but we're above that. A European. Just imagine a Joey's boy hobnobbing with the best of them around the Seven Hills of Rome.
And why not? After all, many of my people are of Italian extraction. It's not perhaps widely known that one of my ancestors was, in fact, Julius Caesar. And Garibaldi was a distant relative on my mother's side. I am 17th in line to the Doge of Venice, and my great-great-granduncle was a Medici, hence my great interest and patronage of the arts. I myself have a very fine collection of paintings and sculptures of myself. Many's the night as a young fella I would bang out a tarantella on the old mandolin with relatives in Lombardy and Tuscany, and Dean Martin was my best man. Aldo Hoy lived in Taormina, where he was a credit enforcer for a local firm, and I also have a couple of cousins who run an insurance business in Palermo. Great sportsmen, their reputations as marksmen with the Lupara, the local favoured shotgun, being near legendary, though Carlo, the elder lad, had a preference for cheese wire. So as anyone who knows me will confirm, Sicilian blood is very much in my veins. Europe, my Europe, this is Kahalo Yoki for 88FM.
I'm watching here, and I can see the younger Oliver at home.
Yeah.
Was it a farm? I can't remember. I'm going to grow up and be that. I'm going to grow up and be that person. And whoever it is doing that, that's what I'm going to do with my life. And so it has come to pass. And so the satire fairy has landed on you and sprinkled good things. It was the range of cultural references that Dermot gathered for that.
You know, Dean Martin is my best man.
What?
Dean Martin.
Yeah,
was my best
man. And the double entendres and particularly in that one, playing with that whole. This is great analysis, isn't it? But playing with that whole underlying notion of hockey as a dangerous man, you know what I mean? And as a man who you would not cross, the whole thing. But never referred to directly in sort of thing. It was just beautifully, they were beautifully done and hugely popular. But as I said, you know, they arose like, he didn't make it up. Hockey gave him the opportunity by claiming to be from, you know, four different places
constantly
in Ireland.
That's right. Who did you play? The Limerick DJ?
The Limerick DJ. Oh, yeah.
Did that upset people in Limerick?
Of course it did. I mean, it's like, I don't know, it sort of, because Limerick people are so funny and so dangerous. I mean, when you think of, you know, when you think of Limerick people in the Dáil over the years, you know, Michael Noonan, very funny man, could be very cutting and very
millions
funny.
Millions and billions.
But yet when, you know, for some reason or other, when a few laughs are pointed in their direction, they immediately go, "You can't say that. You can't say that about us. You can't say that about Limerick people."
This is Jerry Sembridge, the Limerick DJ.
300, what does that mean to you? It means Limerick's on the march. We're driving into the 90s with a new look and a new vice. Limerick's not going to lie down and take it anymore. It's 300 years since the treaty was signed and we're going to let the world know about it. These are exciting times for Limerick folk. Remember how 300 years ago, the women of Limerick came out there with their pots and pans and fought, fought, fought. Well, let's see you do the same today, ladies. Don't let the young fellas have all the fun. We want to see blood on the streets, okay? Confraternity men, sing out loud those great Limerick songs. God of mercy and compassion, we stand for God, faith of our fathers, and Limerick, you're a lady.
It gets madder from there, basically, that they upset you. Jerry, stay where you are. We have to take a break, but stay right there. You like this message, Jerry. Delighted to hear you've Jerry Sembridge on today. 25 years ago, he made a film in our village, Kilmessan, County Meath, Bad Day at Black Rock. Interesting theme, looking at new arrivals in the village, which has become a real issue now. And this is...
As it happens.
Yeah. What are you doing at the IFI?
IFI at Home is the Irish Film Institute's rental. You can rent films and you can put... And they have only in the last 2 weeks put Black Day at Black Rock on their list.
25 years on.
Yeah, you can go online, rent it, view it. It's an hour long and it's a day in the life of a small Irish town that hears that a busload of immigrants are going to be brought to the town.
Very timely.
And at the time, people said, as people tend to say often about satire, "Ah, that's over the top. That kind of stuff doesn't happen. Oh, that doesn't." And then...
You'd never... It was unimaginable that busloads of years later, immigrants would be arriving in small places. That's from John Donoghue in Kilmessan in County Meath, where you made that.
Thank you, John. And yeah.
So it's the IFI streaming service, IFI at home.
IFI streaming service, IFI at home. And follow the links to ignore all the other films, obviously.
Just watch Jerry's one.
Black Day at Black Rock.
Are you going to do another novel?
You never know what you're going to do, but I would doubt. Why write in a form where you have a mysterious nephew who's doing much better than you are at the same kind of thing? And you see,
just design the cover similarly, and you might be accidentally.
Yeah, he doesn't write screenplays or plays.
Jerry Sembridge Lynch. Yes, it's going to be in there. Jerry Sembridge Lynch. You know when you go.
Anyway,
you'll have to come in and talk to us about all the things we missed today.
Less likely.
But in the meantime, happy Easter to you and your family.
Happy Easter to you,
and happy sewing.
And congratulations on all of your shows, all of your many shows.
No, I'll be in trouble. And there you go, some great interviews from the past week. It is the end of the podcast as you know it. If you have interesting stories and things you think we definitely should know, pop us an email anytime at all, oliver@rte.ie. Happy weekend to you, Slán.